Hello, it's Monday, the 16th of August. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. More than a million of us are suffering from long COVID, but could the right diet help you to recover faster? I'm joined by Jane Clark, founder of Nourish by Jane Clark. Finally, the dreaded NHS app ping is over for many of us, with double-jabbed people no longer required to self-isolate. But could it lead to a surge in infections? The Plymouth mass killer described himself as an incel. Do these lonely young men pose a new terror threat? But first, the eyes of the world are on the unfolding disaster in Afghanistan as the Taliban has seized control of the country. What does it mean for the world? The Taliban seized control of Afghanistan last night in what one MP has described as the biggest foreign policy disaster since the Suez Crisis 65 years ago. British nationals and diplomats escaped the country's capital, Kabul, helped by RAF planes, paratroopers and SAS special forces. Well, I'm joined now by Rob Clark, Defence Policy Associate at the Henry Jackson Society and an Afghan war veteran himself. Rob, were you surprised by how quickly the Taliban regained the country?
I was surprised, to be fair, to an extent. I think everybody who's been following the news over the last few months of the withdrawal process knew there would be an inevitability of a form of return to government for elements of the Taliban. However, the speed of this and the speed of their advance, particularly in the last 2 weeks, has been nothing short of breathtaking. Strategically, it's been actually quite impressive what they've accomplished from a military perspective. However, now the humanitarian crisis that we've seen unfolding before our eyes over the last few days really needs to be addressed by both London and Washington. And unfortunately, at the height of political power, there is very little appetite to do so in a robust manner. We've only really seen from the British perspective the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace today, put quite a humane interview on LBC earlier on. But as for the Foreign Secretary and the Secretary of State in America and the President, we've seen very little, which is incredibly disappointing.
What's now likely to happen in Afghanistan over the next couple of weeks?
So I think over the next few weeks, we can expect to see a lot more of the same from the last 36 hours, which is panic, fear, confusion, and anger and frustration, to be honest. We've seen, thousands of Afghan civilians, breaching Kabul airport, trying to be held back by the American army. I think there's been 5 fatalities at least confirmed so far at the airport. This ranges from warning shots to, Afghans who have been literally clinging onto airplanes as they take off, which is just gut-wrenching to see. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this panic. In the next few weeks, the British and American effort based at the airport is to evacuate our citizens and those Afghans who have been intrinsic to the NATO effort. But that process, the evacuation underway, will end almost certainly by the end of August. That's really only 2 weeks. And then the important question is what happens next? And it's the transition, the transitional government. We've seen Afghan President Ashraf Ghani flee to Tajikistan and then, by the sounds of it, to Uzbekistan. He is completely limp-wristed and out of action. We've seen Ahmed Massoud, who is the son of the famous Tajik Northern Alliance commander Ahmed Shah Massoud. His son has gone back to the Panjshir Valley in order to reinforce some form of element to protect Panjshir, which is the only remaining area of Afghanistan not under direct Taliban control. Now, whether Ahmed Massoud and the remnants of what was the Northern Alliance, whether they come back to Kabul in any meaningful way and try to contest power with the Taliban, that's still open to be open to speculation. But Pakistan, increasingly, and China will now be the main power brokers in Afghanistan regarding the nature of a transitional government, which will inevitably be controlled by the Taliban.
I was watching an interview earlier with a British veteran who was marking the day today of what he rather darkly called his bangiversary, and that was the day that he lost both of his legs in an explosion. He also spoke about losing 3 of his colleagues in that theatre. He said and has tweeted publicly that he feels that he lost his legs in vain, and he feels that his colleagues lost their lives also in vain. He won't be alone in that, will he?
Oh, absolutely not. I've had many messages over the weekend from ex-colleagues and soldiers and veterans over social media asking that very question. Was it all in vain? And, you know, what was the purpose? And one has to remember, to be perfectly frank, my opinion, and it's completely subjective, by the way, but my opinion, I believe, is relatively steadfast. And that is, well, we have not sustained a single terrorist attack in the West, you know, launched from Afghanistan since 9/11. And that is purely because of the military effort and the removal of the Taliban in power. Now, obviously, the Taliban didn't commit the atrocities of 9/11, but they facilitated it in the most heinous way by offering sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. And just one on that, we can already foresee a return to that previous status quo. Only on Sunday, the Nangarhar province governor was removed by the Taliban, and the Taliban actually installed a Haqqani network prescribed terrorist as the new governor. And now the Haqqani network, and this is through an independent UN report in June, listed very significant and serious relationships still persist between the Haqqani network and Al-Qaeda. So we can already see very real likelihood of a return to the pre-9/11 conditions in Afghanistan, which is a breeding ground for international extremist terrorism.
Rob, many thanks. That was Rob Clark, Defence Policy Associate at the Henry Jackson Society. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. The man who shot five people dead in Plymouth last week was a self-described incel. Incels, short for involuntary celibate, are members of misogynistic online groups who blame women for their own sexual failings. There's often crossover with other far-right online groups too. So should they be treated as a new terror threat? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Lewis Brace, a lecturer in data analysis, extremism and cybercrime at the University of Exeter. Many people, Dr. Brace, until this tragedy unfolded, would never have heard the word incel. Just talk a little more about what it means.
Yes, yeah, so the notion of the incel is relatively new in the UK. It first became a sort of quote-unquote household name in the US in 2014, following a killing spree by a young man named Elliot Rodger, who tried to target a sorority house. Since that attack in 2014, there have been a number of incel-related violent incidents in both the US and Canada, including Alec Manassian's van attack. As far as the UK is concerned, the incel ideology is a relatively recent import. There was a trial up in Scotland earlier this year of a young man who was convicted of terrorism-related offences and planning an attack, who appears to have some association with the incel ideology. The incels themselves, their ideology is based around the notion that certain genetic factors, the things that make up our height, bone structure, eye colour, all those kind of things, are biologically predetermined. And that they also believe that these are the sole traits that women look for in a male partner. They then believe that these traits in themselves are substandard, and that they are therefore, in their views, doomed to a life of involuntary celibacy. And this notion of involuntary celibacy is obviously where we get the portmanteau incel.
Are these people simply psychologically deranged?
That's an argument we've seen in the terrorism radicalization literature for a good few decades now. And it's one that's slowly peeling away as research into radicalization and extremism progresses and we're starting to use more and more empirical data. What the data now shows is that individuals who get radicalized by certain ideologies don't often vary in terms of psychological makeup to the general population. There's a unique feature that my research seems to indicate about the incels compared to other extremist ideologies so far. And that's that if you look at other ideologies such as Salafism or some far-right ideologies, these individuals, like I said, they don't normally vary too much from the wider general population in terms of psychological traits. When we look at the incels, barring some quote-unquote true believers such as Elliot Rodgers or Alec Manassian, individuals who, most of the other individuals who commit acts of violence in the name of inceldom, often tend to, if you look at their psychological makeup, they often tend to have other psychological, social issues going on, and the incel ideology then appears to essentially be a sort of sprinkling on the top, if that makes sense. It seems to be a way for them to characterise their frustrations and the issues they're experiencing in their personal life.
And do these people simply identify as being incel, or is this an organised online group to which you can subscribe, and should they be classed now as a terror threat?
Okay, so there's two questions there. Let's tackle the first one. This group is not organised, okay? While some people are being radicalised by this ideology, the radicalisation of incel is sort of fits a broader pattern that we're seeing with other ideologies, such as the far right and so on. Okay, and these cases of radicalisation are happening from an individual's interaction online with other like-minded members. Okay, there's no central authority organising or dictating the output of propaganda. It's just individuals interacting online. This is a phenomenon we often call self-radicalization, and we've seen this with a number of high-profile right-wing extremist attacks, such as the New Zealand Christchurch shooter, the Poe synagogue shooter, and the El Paso Walmart attack. In regards to your second question about whether or not these individuals should be considered a terror threat, the ideology itself is clearly a security concern, but whether or not it will be treated as a quote-unquote terror threat depends upon the specific, it will be very much a case-by-case basis, okay? So as I said before, if you look at Elliot Rodger and Alec Manassian, those attacks were clearly terrorist attacks. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the empirical evidence in terrorism research and studies, what we define to be a terrorist attack, by and large, tends to be an act of violence with the sole intention of instilling fear in a population with the idea of bringing around political change. And although many people argue about definitions of terrorism, most of us working in the field would argue that it's that key aspect of trying to induce political change that makes an act of violence a terrorist act of violence. In the case of incels, this translates to, this all goes back to what I was saying a minute ago about these individuals having other issues going on, right? So Alec Manassian and Elliot Rodger, these guys left behind manifestos where they clearly stated that they were trying to create, quote-unquote, an incel uprising and change, bring around a change in society. Many other incel-related acts of violence have, like I said, they haven't really left behind a manifesto, and it looks as though these individuals had other issues going on. Some of them already exhibited various violent tendencies prior to this, and it seems like the incel ideology has been more of a way to sort of frame sort of a certain amount of behaviour, and that they're not really subscribing to the ideology itself. Indeed, the individual who committed the attack last Thursday, from what we've been able to piece together of his online footprint, in the past few months, it looks as though he was trying to leave the incel subculture because he deemed it to be having a negative impact on his mental health. But again, I do want to stress that bit is very... That has to be clarified, yeah. It's still very early days in terms of sort of piecing this together.
Well, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Many thanks for taking the time. That was Dr. Lewis Brace, lecturer in Data Analysis, Extremism and Cybercrime at the University of Exeter. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at The Spur Show. From today, those who have been double jabbed and under 18 will no longer be required to isolate for 10 days if they are pinged by the NHS app or contacted by the Test and Trace service. Experts have warned that people with both vaccine shots can still catch and pass on the disease, so it may lead to a rise in infections. Well, I'm joined now by Lawrence Young, Professor of Molecular Oncology at Warwick Medical School. Just talk first of all about the effect you think this will have on infections.
Well, it comes at an interesting time when the daily case numbers are really high, and one of the concerns that we've seen recently reflected in the ONS data is that we've got 25 times as many people infected now as the same time last year, and that while the vaccine is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, we're certainly not out of the woods in terms of the ability of this virus to infect people, to spread and to cause disease.
Now, test and trace has been an extremely controversial practice and incredibly vexing for individuals and businesses. Do you think it was the right way to proceed? But is it now time to scrap it?
Yeah, I think it was the right way to proceed. And I accept that the pandemic, you know, has been really challenging in terms of test and trace. And indeed, the ping-demic, it was not sort of sustainable. But I don't think we should let our guard down in terms of test, trace and isolate. It's really important that people who do test positive or are close to people who test positive get their PCR, the tests done, and isolate. And I worry now that with all these changes, there's a sense that somehow, you know, the pandemic has gone away, the virus has gone away, and we can all go back to normal life. When you can't do that, when you've got more than 30,000 cases a day and people are still getting sick.
Because we thought initially, or many people thought, that being double jabbed would be the end of the problem and the end of the chapter. Actually, I know lots of people who've been double jabbed and have got COVID, but just with milder symptoms. And that is the way it now works, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, the whole game has changed with this Delta variant. It's quite clear that if you're double vaccinated, you can still get infected with this Delta variant and you can still spread the virus, even though you're double vaccinated. And that means you can spread it to people who are vulnerable. You can spread it to people who've only had one jab. And that's why I think we still need to be on our guard.
What is the current rate of infection and when will we see it start to decrease?
Well, as I said earlier, from the ONS data, we're seeing something like 1 in 75 people are infected in England. And that is a concentration of infection, particularly in younger folk. So that's, again, a concern, particularly in terms of the uptake of vaccination in the 18 to 30-year-olds. I think it's very likely with the change today and with changes as we go into September and schools and colleges go back and people perhaps aren't on holiday, therefore they're more confined to indoor spaces, we are likely to see an increase in the number of cases. The issue, of course, is how will that translate into hospitalizations? We know that hospitalizations are increasing, obviously nowhere near what we were experiencing last year before the vaccine. But I do think we need to perhaps you know, look at other countries. And I would highlight Israel, who were ahead of the game in terms of vaccination, let their guard down in terms of test, trace and isolate in May, and are now suffering the consequences.
And there's still confusion over pregnant women and whether they should be taking the vaccine. Just a quick note on that, if you will.
Yeah, I think all the data is looking really good in terms of the safety profile of the vaccine in pregnant women, but also the risk of not getting vaccinated is significant. And we know, sadly, a number of pregnant women are being hospitalized with the infection. What we need to do is make sure that the pregnant women come forward for vaccination. It is safe, very effective, and protects, obviously, mother and child.
And just finally, will we ever see a day when nobody has COVID in the UK?
I think it's going to take some time, Richard. I think it's going to be an interesting 6 months now as we head into the winter period. We are going to settle into living with this virus. It's not going to disappear. We may need to have annual jabs against it, but I think it's the next 6 months where we're going to hopefully see that settling as we get more people vaccinated and we get through what will be a challenging winter with other respiratory infections alongside COVID. But it will settle into a pattern that I guess will be very similar to what we're used to with flu.
Lawrence, always good to talk to you. That was Lawrence Young, Professor of Molecular Oncology at Warwick Medical School. In March this year, more than 1 million people were reporting symptoms associated with long COVID, according to the Office for National Statistics. But can choosing the right foods help you to recover? Well, author and food expert Jane Clark believes that nutrition can play a vital part in helping people bounce back from long COVID faster. And she joins me now. Just talk a little bit about your approach to this, Jane.
So I think, like any medical practitioner, it's very much learning on the job. You know, we're dealing with a new symptom, new range of symptoms for people, and what one person calls long COVID is different to someone else. But really, one of the key elements that I've been looking at over the last few months / year looking after patients with long COVID is really the inflammation within the body, because inflammation is something that we seem to see in more and more patients that really seem to struggle with the long symptoms of really dealing with COVID moving forward.
One of the most worrying and stressful elements of COVID and of long COVID is the loss of smell and or taste, which we take so very much for granted. How long can that persist? How long does it usually persist? And can you do anything to speed that process of it returning up?
Well, the loss of taste and smell is one thing that actually we're still not seeing much groundbreaking research in. It's one of the elements that there's a lot you can do with long COVID. So a lot of the fatigue, a lot of the emotional elements, a lot of the inflammation, the pain within the body, you can do a lot by looking at foods that are naturally anti-inflammatory. So they're your omegas, they're your foods that are sort of full of the good oils, the proteins, the good sugars, the antioxidants. But when we look at someone who's lost their taste and smell, one of the things to try and override is perhaps one of people's fears about putting flavoring within food, so salt, because we tend to think salt is the big baddie that we mustn't go anywhere near. But actually, when you've lost your sense of taste or smell, a little bit of salt in your food, obviously as long as you've not got heart disease and a medical condition that means you need to avoid salt, sometimes it's that tiny little bit of salt that then can bring back your appetite. Because the vicious circle that many of my patients have got into prior to coming to see me is the body's cruel. You tend to eat very little, then you lose your appetite, and then it makes you want to eat even less. And then you go in the malnutrition sort of undernourished spiral. But there's actually a very exciting area where I'm seeing some real progress for patients. And that's actually looking at histamine within the body. Now, we tend to think that histamine is all about allergies, hay fever, asthma. But a lot of patients that are struggling with a big amount of the fatigue, the inflammation, the pain within the body are actually seeing that if they look at reducing the amount of high histamine foods, they actually start to feel a bit better. So this, whilst we don't know because we haven't had the research to support this yet, because it's still early days, I think it's well worth looking at, because if you can look at foods that are high in histamine and avoid those, and they tend to be things like dried fruits, avocados, smoked meats, fermented foods, because histamine tends to build up as food sort of tends to be preserved. So by avoiding those foods, with some patients that I'm looking after, it can make a real difference to how well they feel.
It's a bit difficult though, isn't it? Because often we consider various grains and pulses and avocados to be foods that are incredibly good for us.
We do. So grains, pulses, yes, they are good for you. But if you've been tending to sort of have too much of the high histamine foods, like the dried fruits, the pickled things, or things that are very smoked and things that have been around in tins or ready-made foods, they can be richer in histamine. And perhaps go, and I know it's easy for us to say, go for more things that are fresh, then it can make a difference to how tired you feel. And obviously, if you can just break that cycle, then that gives you more energy to then start looking the other things that you can do in your diet.
So if you have got long COVID, should you be taking antihistamines as you would if you got hay fever, perhaps, or an allergy?
There's no medical research to support that, so I definitely wouldn't suggest that's a sort of carte blanche for everyone. But start to look, and a really good thing to do is to keep a little note of what you're eating, what you're drinking, and how your body's feeling. And just have a look and just see, have I perhaps been having things that are high in histamine? Or another trap that people fall into is when you're feeling exhausted or when you're really craving something with flavor, you go for the really sweet things. And of course, you know, we don't need telling, but perhaps it's a good little reminder to know that when you have something that's really sweet, you then feel great for a minute or a few minutes, but then you get that horrible crash. And by looking at your diary, your food diary, and how you're feeling, that can perhaps show you little patterns that you didn't realize you'd fallen into, and just try and make small changes. And it's amazing how by looking at small changes in your diet, perhaps looking at inflammation-rich food, you know, the foods that take down inflammation, looking at the histamine, looking at whether you've been quick fixing on the sugars, those small things could just perhaps make a difference.
And just finally, what would be your top five foods that you should be eating if you've got long COVID?
I would say definitely, because inflammation is a big thing where we're seeing people suffering with that. I would say I go for your good fats. So that's your olive oil. That's your lovely walnuts, your oily fish. So that's your salmon, your tuna, your sardines, your mackerel, making a simple smoked mackerel pate. Going for, obviously, I wouldn't be a nutritionist if I didn't say, you know, fruits, vegetables, but they can be frozen, because frozen fruits and vegetables can just be as nourishing and high in vitamin C, just as much as fresh, and they're easier and more economical. And I definitely say hydration is a big thing, because hydration helps the body get rid of toxins. It helps keeps your temperature in good control and helps keep energy perhaps at the best it could be.
So drink lots of water too. Always good advice. Many thanks. Very interesting. That was author and nutrition expert Jane Clark, founder of Nourish by Jane Clark. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.